Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. The treatment with rhodiola mimics exercise to resist high-fat diet-induced muscle dysfunction. Central South University in China. I'll tell you what that means and why it's important and what rhodiola can do for you. It's just one of many of the natural plant-based compounds that we can benefit from. And by the way, over 75% of the people in China who came down with COVID were also treated with traditional Chinese medicine. Not a word in the American media about that. Also, we'll talk about how prenatal exposure to pesticides increases the risk of obesity in adolescents from Barcelona Institute for Global Health. A lot on health and healing today. But most of the program today is devoted to continuing our pushback against those individuals who feel that they have a right, without experience, without scholarship, without contributing anything, building anything, but tearing everything down because somehow they feel offended. How did this happen? Well, we're going to look at the coddling of the American mind, moderated by Malcolm Gladwell, in a panel with Jonathan Haidt and Leonore Skinzi. It'll be an interesting discussion. So they came up with some original research to show you how in 2013 this happened. And then I have my own input on this and commentary of what I believe they have left out of the equation. And that's based upon my experience counseling thousands of individuals. And I found this was a contributing factor to the woke generation and their need for constant safety. Also today, will Elon Musk merge with you through artificial intelligence? What do I mean? Russell Brand, the British original comedian, and who today is an advocate for more freedoms, he has an analysis. But in that analysis, you're also going to see some video clips. That's why I'd like for you to go to prn.fm, scroll down, and you'll see where you can watch it in real time. And this is important. This is a part of an ongoing series of why I believe artificial intelligence is so dangerous, even though it's going to be gift-wrapped to make it look like everybody should have this brain implant. So they're now planting chips and people all over the world. There's almost a rush. There's parties. There's implant parties in Great Britain right now where people gather every night in large groups to have that chip implanted in there. It's about the size of a grain of brown rice between their thumb and forefinger. And wow, for what? So they can open a door? So they can use that as a credit card? Do they have any idea what they're doing? They're now allowing themselves to be monitored 24/7. So we're going to talk about now they're going into your brain with artificial intelligence. But listen very carefully because you're going to hear Elon Musk warn you on three different occasions in his short discussion about the problems. But he doesn't go into the problems. He just says this is, you know, could be really bad. But he doesn't explain what's bad. I'll explain what's bad because I've been studying this in depth. Also, if time permits, Bill Gates endorsed a book. And I want to know, why would anyone read this book? And what does it tell us about Bill Gates? What do you hear about the book? It's all about lying, deceiving the public. It's 11 minutes long. It's worth listening to. And it's a real book. It's out there. It's been out there. So you're going to learn more about the character of a person who wants more control in your life. Also, commentaries today. Today's commentary day and your opportunity to talk back. We're going to talk about, for example, Twitter isn't censoring accounts to keep us safe. It is using its power to spoon-feed the world establishment narratives. Eva Bartlett, RTV. Also, who the biggest polluter in the world, the rich. Rich people are fueling climate catastrophe, but not mostly because of their consumption. Matt Huber of commentary. Also, I'll be talking about how Denmark ditched Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine, saying benefits, quote, do not outweigh risks of blood clots. Didn't hear that in America. And also today, my hero of the day is a rabbi. And this rabbi put it in writing, dear doctor, his own doctor. And I want you to hear what he wrote. It's a short letter. But because of that, Rabbi Michael Green was attacked by the Rabbinical Association. And he fought back. In effect, by one letter exercising his freedom of speech, he no longer has freedom of speech. But wait till you hear why they would want him to be silenced. So we're going to deal with that. Also, I'm going to get to a couple more important commentaries, including one more on the cancel culture. According to The Telegraph and Craig Simpson, Chaucer courses are being replaced by models on race and sexuality under the University of Leicester plans. I mentioned yesterday how they were going to, in effect, erase and attack Newton for being racist, which he was not, probably the greatest mathematician up till the modern era, in which a lot of science was based, and all the other people, Hume, Locke, all being attacked and erased by people who have no knowledge of history, have not read the classics, do not understand the importance of honoring the authentic chapters in our history that allowed us to develop an age of reason and go forward and leave a lot of superstition and bad habits behind. All that is being erased. So we'll challenge that. So we have a lot to share today. And we begin always with the latest on health and healing. And then any time that you feel you'd like to contribute something by sharing your thoughts, please do. Just dial us at 888-874-4888. Rhodiola, R-H-O-D-I-O-L-A. That's a very important herb. It has a full spectrum of ways it can help us. But according to the reporting out of China, quote, muscle dysfunction is a complication of the high-fat diet-induced obesity that can be prevented by exercise, but patients did not get enough therapeutic efficacy from exercise due to multiple reasons, meaning the more overweight you are, the less likely you are to be able to engage in a really good quality exercise program. You just have too much weight on the body. Also can be dangerous to your heart, to suddenly have a lot of extra weight that the heart has to pump that blood to get it all throughout your system. So in comes this simple herb, rhodiola. And they found that by giving rhodiola to the patients, it helps prevent and treat muscle dysfunction in individuals who are overweight or obese. And that is terrific. So if you're overweight, want to exercise, just include rhodiola as a part of your overall health program. We've known for a long time that air pollution is extremely dangerous. We don't always see it. We think of air pollution as looking up in the sky and seeing either chemtrails with all the barium and aluminum and other toxic minerals that are hanging up there for a little bit of time and then settle to the ground, go into the water, where they do not biodegrade, are taken up by the fish, you eat the fish, suddenly you've got all this lead, mercury, cadmium, barium in you that you do not want. These are toxic heavy minerals. Or it goes into the soil, and therefore you grow something, it can be absorbed into the plant. So we never looked at what happens when you're in a very polluted environment and you end up getting the pesticides, for example. We'll just use one example, into your body. This is what it's showing, that when a mother is exposed to persistent organic pollutants, what are called POPs, or organochlorine pesticides. These are the industrial chemicals. People use them on their backyards to kill insects, on trees to get rid of some kind of moth or aphid or pest, that increase the risk of your baby during adolescence, growing up, and having metabolic disorders like obesity and high blood pressure. This was the main conclusion in a major study by the Barcelona Institute for Global Health, a research center that is giving us this data. And they looked at 400 children living in Menorca who were followed from birth until 18 years of age. It's a long-term study. And they found that if they were exposed to pesticides, they ended up being more obese and having high blood pressure. So we're seeing that air pollution is a big deal, but the air pollution has to get into the air, and we are creating that air pollution by industrial effluents or by what we spray around our house. Good news from Edith Cowan University, which is in Australia. One single cup of a green leafy vegetable each day lowers your risk of heart disease. Just one cup of the green leafy vegetables, like celery, for example, kale, arugula, collard greens, lettuces, parsley, all good. And in our anti-aging study, they're drinking 12 glasses of juice a day and really detoxifying. Researchers found that by eating just one cup of nitrate-rich vegetables each day, people can significantly reduce their risk of heart disease. Wow, that's good news. So for all of you who've been juicing, you're on the right side of that issue, and you're flooding your body with antioxidants in the process. This study was published in the European Journal of Epidemiology. It was also in association with the Danish Cancer Society and the University of Western Australia. Now, from the University of Derby, which is in the United Kingdom, mindfulness programs can boost children's mental health. That means all of your school-age children, and can help them feel more optimistic, according to the study. And more than 1,000 pupils aged 9 to 12 across 25 schools in Derbyshire received a 45-minute mindfulness session each week, just once a week, for 9 weeks during the year-long project. And it made a big difference. And by the way, I realize not everybody knows about what mindful meditation is. It's an ancient meditation technique that involves focusing awareness on the present moment as a means of fostering calm, well-being, and insight, so that we are practicing focusing on your breathing, breathing deep and diaphragmatically, by listening to birds, just keep your mind on the birds, or paying attention to looking at a tree. If the tree's in the wind and swaying, just watch that tree. Or if you're near the ocean, watching the waves, mindful. So anything that gets your single focus and you just keep your attention on that, that's practicing mindful breathing, mindful attention, and it can affect all your body sensations. So it just cultivates attention skills and greater awareness of emotions. It also is one way you can stop yourself from going ballistic and going rageful. Just be able to pull yourself back and be calm, breathe deep, for about a minute, then reflect upon, it's just information. What can I do with it? I don't have to emote on everything that happens to me. I don't have to take everything personally. That creates emotional resiliency and emotional stability, well-being, and reduces stress. Could we all use that? Yes. From Johns, that's with an S, Hopkins University, an article published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism found that vitamin D levels are higher in exercisers, and that reduces the risk of heart disease and heart failure. So it just makes you a healthier person, strengthens your immune system. So it's just good. Anything that can reduce your risk of a heart attack or stroke is good, especially something that's natural and non-toxic like vitamin D. 1 teaspoon daily of trehalose can help maintain glucose homeostasis. This is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study, and it was done in Japan. And by the way, tree, T-R-E, halose, H-A-L-O-S-E, is a natural disaccharide that is widely distributed. And they found that it improves glucose tolerance in individuals with signs of metabolic syndrome, like prediabetes or diabetes. And it was done in this way, a very specific study, and it was a double-blind study. So it just helped people maintain better blood glucose. So I'll spell it again. It's T-R-E-H-A-L-O-S-E, something you probably haven't heard of before. And that's it on health and nutrition. We're 16 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, we're going to go to a video clip. Again, you can watch these on prn.fm. Scroll down, you'll see it. Or you can listen, and you will hear a discussion, very heavy, heavyweight discussion, because then we begin our journey of understanding what is causing so many young people to feel that everything in life is a threat to them and everything scares them. They're unprepared for anything involving the real world. Now, this is not every kid, but the internet makes it possible that every kid, no matter what their socioeconomic status, no matter what their educational status, is vulnerable. But then there's a subgroup that's extremely vulnerable, and I'll tell you who they are and why I know, and show you some of the outcomes of that, see if it makes sense to you. But now we're going to start dissecting over the next several weeks with some of the world's leading thought leaders on this topic. And by the way, for the 45,034 people who downloaded the self-empowerment videos off PRN.fm, and they're free. We now have, I believe, almost close to 80 of them up there. 80 different videos, and these were discovered in my archive. They'd never been released, and they're really, really good on all topics, dealing with fear, dealing with anger, dealing with depression, dealing with anxiety, dealing with loneliness, dealing with grief, all the different topics. And you wouldn't know that they weren't broadcast yesterday. But they're there as a public service. And already 45,034 people have downloaded them. That's according to Jesse in PRN, who just gave me those statistics. So there's a tool. Use them. They're free. All right? Take what you want. Use it. If you don't agree with something, don't use it. And by the way, good for the Ontario police officers who launched a charter challenge of the pandemic restrictions. According to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, Colin Butler, quote, a group of 19 Ontario police officers has launched a constitutional challenge against the provincial and federal governments and several police chiefs, claiming that enforcing sweeping pandemic health restrictions put them at odds with their oath to uphold the charter. So, some top police officers and rank and file in Canada are pushing back against the non-scientific, draconian ways that Canada is dealing with COVID. I'd like to see the same thing from police in the United States. I'd like to see. I just had this idea last night about all 800,000 more or less police in the United States go back into training specifically for not to harm a suspect, but rather how to minimize every kind of harm you could do. Where is it said that you have to do a kill shot? If you are faced with someone who represents a clear and present danger with another gun, then train them to shoot the legs. Train them in the art of de-escalating a crisis. Train them in restraint, and then demilitarize them. Get rid of all of this battle gear that they're wearing, and thank Obama for that, for giving the Defense Department the authorization to militarize all the police. We need in every community in the United States, members of the police force, to go back into their communities, the very communities where they live, and go to church or mosque or synagogue, and where they have friends and family, and set up an office that is a community office open 24/7 where members of that community are there at the same time the police from that community are there where they can handle problems in that community. That's not done, and it should be, because at least in the people would feel that the police are there to serve and protect and not there to frisk and search or to shoot and to stop this nonsense of what we see otherwise. People should not fear the police, and the police should not fear the people. If we can do that, I believe we would make a difference in the outcome of violence and make neighborhoods where people are very vulnerable safer for them, especially in inner cities where the poorest people live and have the least police protection and the most violence. So we could do this and then start a trial program, take it into Chicago or other places where there's a lot of crime, and see what happens when you take a different mindset, a different approach. But you've got to get police back into a training program. Look, I teach and have for a long time doctors through a continuing education medical credits, all-day sessions, so they can see that they're up to date on everything. Why can't the police do the same thing, where you show how to de-escalate a crisis, how to de-escalate a problem? We're not doing it. We should. Just my thoughts. And, oh, by the way, I'll share some thoughts about free speech in a few moments, but we're going to come back and we're going to hear about the children with Dr. and Jonathan Haidt and others. Stay with us. Got a lot to share today.
Thank you to all of our guests joining us this evening.
The blowback was so immediate, I really hadn't realized how scared my generation of parents had become to let their kids do anything on their own, even though we all grew up loving our freedom as kids. And the disconnect between the way we were raising our own kids and the way we appreciated being raised just struck me as bizarre, and I've just been, you know, sort of exploring my way through it since.
You say you were unaware of how afraid your generation had become as parents. But you must have been at least partially aware if you
wrote
thought it was
column.
Worthy of an article to write about how your kid was riding
the
subway, right?
That's why he has 5 bestsellers. Got one. Just right for a minute. Here's what happened. We let him ride the subway, and then I didn't write about it immediately because it didn't strike me as that big a deal, but I was talking to some of the other fourth grade parents, and they were like, "You did what?" And I was like, "Yeah, we let him ride the subway," and they were going to wait till their kids were older, like 38 or 39, and when I heard that, I wanted to write it, but I have to confess that when I looked back at old columns of mine, I used to be at the Daily News, not anymore, anyway, I found columns of mine from when they were like 4 and 6, and I said, yeah, I let them go to the bathroom at the New Victory Theater without me traipsing their boys, without me going in. Is that terrible? And I let them play downstairs in our courtyard when they were, I don't know, 7 and 9. Is that so terrible? And so I realized that had been a theme, which was I just didn't understand why we were so afraid of strangers. I'm a reporter by trade. All I do is talk to strangers. So that really got my gall. And as a reporter, I knew that the crime rate today is lower.
We'll get that back. We had a little technical glitch. It's called freezing. And we'll see when that's available, and it'll come right back up. So, okay.
Let's fight.
Yeah. John and Greg, how did you come to what was behind the original, this foray into,
actually, you should start
the book, Coddling America?
Well, first thing I want to say as a disclaimer is that I'm recovering from a concussion from a car accident. So if I say anything stupid, that's the concussion. But if I say anything really good, that's all me. So I was the weird person who went to law school specifically to do First Amendment law. I took every class that my law school offered. I did 6 credits on censorship during the Tudor dynasty when I ran out of classes to take on the First Amendment. I interned at the ACLU of Northern California. This was my lifelong passion. And I started working for a new organization. I became the first legal director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary this
Yay!
Year. And even back in 2001, it was easier to get in trouble for what you said on a college campus than most people thought. But at the time, who you'd get in trouble with was overwhelmingly administrators. And there was this kind of conservative stereotype about students being the ones reporting their professors and demanding speech codes, and that was just not true. Another kind of curveball in the story is, and it's, you know, a little bit of a dark turn, is around 2007, I had a very bad bout of depression, like a scary, hopefully the worst I'll ever have, and I ended up being hospitalized for it. And the thing that really helped me deal with, and I had issues with depression my whole life, but the thing that really made these battles winnable, pretty much from this point on, was cognitive behavioral therapy. So I was working on campus defending freedom of speech while trying to train myself to not catastrophize a cognitive distortion that can make you anxious and depressed, to not personalize, to not engage in black and white thinking, to not overgeneralize. All these things are cognitive distortions that depressed and anxious people do a lot. And amazingly, if you get in the habit of talking back to those kind of exaggerated voices, it's very effective at dealing with anxiety and depression. And I was watching on campus administrators, in my opinion, exercising modes of behavior that seem to be saying to students, you're in great danger all the time. And at the time I was like, well, but thank goodness students aren't taking these lessons to heart. And unfortunately, that seemingly changed overnight. 2013, 2014, at the time we had no clue exactly why. Students who used to be the best constituency for free speech on campus suddenly became, to some degree, sort of like the stereotypes people have of the don't you dare say that kind of attitude very, 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 very quickly. And what was strange about it was that they were sort of medicalizing the reasons for it. They were saying, not, I don't want this guy on my campus because I hate him and he's a bigot. I don't want this guy speaking on my campus because it will be psychologically harmful. To people I know, usually not to me, but to other people. Other unnamed people will be harmed by their presence. And this sounded exactly like what I was frightened was going to happen in terms of sort of bad pseudo-medicalization, pseudo-psychological thinking. Mm-hmm. So I'd recently become friends with John, and we went to get lunch at an Indian place down in the village, and we chatted about the idea, and to my delight, he wanted to write an article about it.
So, John, are there, were there specific incidents in your own experience that led you to think that there was a broader trend going on?
Yeah. So I've been teaching since 1987 when I started graduate school and at Penn and then at Chicago and then for 16 or 17 years at the University of Virginia. And I thought the job of a teacher, or at least how to be a good teacher, is you provoke a variety of emotions during class, you get people to look at things from different perspectives, you lead them through a path which sometimes is uncomfortable, and then you resolve it. And so there can be like a dramatic structure to a class. And so that's the way I always taught, and I always trusted my students and felt that they trusted me. And then I moved to NYU in 2011, and it's not so much moving from UVA to NYU, it's that suddenly, for the first time in the spring of 2014, I mean, it really was overnight. It was like from out of nowhere.
It was really strange.
In the spring of 2014, I had several incidents where students reported me to the dean and demanded that he do something about things I'd said in class, like teaching the Milgram experiment. One student thought that I was saying that the Nazis were okay. It was just this level of,
you shouldn't have said that. They weren't okay.
So, there was just the sense that students would give you the benefit of the doubt because you're all in this together, you're trying to put on a great class together, that seemed to vanish after a couple of such complaints, and I was really puzzled. And one student was talking about issues in terms of I don't feel safe, and I was like, what do you mean? I couldn't understand it. And this was all in the spring of 2014, and so when Greg invited me to lunch in May of 2014, you know, it's sort of like, you know, like you're seeing, you know, people turn into zombies here and there, and suddenly a guy comes along and says, you know, in the lab, I just found this new kind of parasite. And so he told me his idea. I said, oh, my God, this is brilliant. I sort of suggest, oh, you should write that up, and I should write it up with you. That was the Origin of the Atlantic article.
A question for all of you. The one thing that all of you have in common is that you live on the East Coast of the United States in relatively privileged areas. Mm-hmm.
Queens.
John.
Southeast D.C.
John, you just mentioned Penn, Chicago, Virginia, NYU. I don't see the University of Southern Kentucky on that list.
Right.
How certain are you that the phenomenon you're describing is national, or do you think it is specific to privileged quarters of pampered American life?
Let me take that for starters, because as we've been talking about the book around the country, I always ask a few different questions, and when I meet with administrators, I ask various questions. And one thing that I found is wherever you go, anywhere in America, if you're dealing with kids born after 1995, everybody from the college president through the professors, through the guitar teacher, through the counseling center, everybody is saying, what hit us? The anxiety, the depression, there's a tsunami of it. The soccer coach says, I mean, like all of a sudden, if you criticize a kid, you know, she won't come back to, you know, she quits the team. And so the fragility, the anxiety, the depression, that is totally national. The politicization of it, the idea that people are vulnerable, not me necessarily, but her and him and them, they're vulnerable, and therefore I'm going to call you out and destroy you because you said something that I, you know, et cetera. It's that call-out culture, that is not national. That is, if you look at the top liberal arts colleges in the Northeast and the West Coast and Chicago, you find it. In fact, that's where all the shoutdowns have been. We have a map at Heterodox Academy. We created a map where every shoutdown, where a speaker was literally shouted down so they couldn't speak, and it's all right along the Eastern Seaboard and the rim of the Pacific Coast and Chicago.
Yeah.
So what's special about, Lenora, why don't you start with?
Wait, I had a Kentucky story. I couldn't believe it. You mentioned a state that I know something about. So can I just tell you where?
Yes. We're always open to Kentucky stories.
This is that's the 92nd Street Wise motto, where Kentucky stories live.
Highly specific.
Right. That's why I come here. So this lady wrote to me about a month ago. She's in Kentucky, and every afternoon when her son, who's 9, gets dropped off by the school bus, the rule that the school has is that there has to be an adult waiting at the bus stop to walk him home. It's actually, you can see her house from the bus stop. And she has her father normally walk him home. One day the dad was in the bathroom, and one day the kid wasn't supposed to come home, and so the grandfather wasn't waiting to walk him home. But if it becomes a third time, she gets reported to Child Protective Services because she is neglecting this child, and the child has to go back to the bus depot, which seems like the least safe place you could possibly take a kid in Kentucky. But so you're wondering, how do kids get so fragile? They're being told, they're being forced to be supervised every single second, even in Kentucky. And then the rationale for that is that otherwise they're not safe. And it's like, they are safe, but if you're always being told that you're not safe, when you are safe, nothing seems safe. And I think that's why we hear the word, I don't feel safe on campus, because that's just become the watchword for everything.
And if I could just add one thing on the class issue, and I take the class issue extremely seriously, and in the book we recommend several books, including Putnam's Our Kids, which I think is just absolutely fabulous. I do feel like in my work at FIRE, we still see at schools that tend to be more sort of working class, more commuter schools, we still see cases exactly like the kind of cases I was seeing in 2005, where students are being told that they can't protest outside of a tiny little free speech zone. A lot of these sort of like administrators throwing their weight around, don't you dare criticize the university case. But when it comes to these highly ideological cases, we do see them at more elite colleges.
A couple questions. John, you mentioned something happened around students born in 1995. Mm-hmm. Well, let's dig into this.
Okay.
What happened in 1995?
Take it away.
And Lenore, you can chime in on this. This shift that you have identified in attitudes of parents, can you also locate the point at which this?
I can't locate it perfectly, but I can tell you that it is this generation and possibly a little bit of the generation right before it. 1984, we started putting the pictures of the missing kids on milk cartons, and we neglected to say, by the way, this was a runaway, or this kid was taken in a custodial dispute,
yep.
Right, in a divorce battle. And I think if you're growing up with, you know, here's your Rice Krispies, and here's the person who's been missing, it's really, there's a parade of them, you know, it's like, who's it, it's like, you know, it's like a series. And so that, I think, became, you know, we really became obsessed with the idea of predators and no child ever being safe. And that's when the crime really was ramping up.
Yeah.
From, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, it peaks in 93, but the fear keeps going, even though the crime went down. So I can't say exactly when, but I do feel like this idea that any child that is not supervised is going to be snatched off their bike starts with the milk cartons.
But I think that's more the background. That's the pre-story. Mm-hmm. So Greg and I structured the book around this mystery of why is it so sudden? Why did it come out of nowhere with kids born in 1995?
Mm-hmm.
And so we think there's six different intersecting threads that really all come together. And that is one of them. That is the background of increasing paranoia. And Lenore's always talking about this. Somehow in the 90s or early 2000s, we got the idea that if you take your eye off your kid just to reach for a carton of milk, they're going to be snatched.
Milk again!
That's right. But we think that there's two major factors here that combined. So one is the vast overprotection. The central idea in the book is that human beings are anti-fragile. That is, kids might look fragile, but actually the evolutionary design is for us to go out, fall down a few times, then we learn how to stand up. We reach for something, it drops, we learn how, you know. We're built to learn by trial and error, where kids seek out risk. Once they master something, they try to make it more dangerous. That's what they need to do. And beginning maybe in the 90s, we started saying, risk? How about zero? How about no risk? Is that good for you? And so we basically deprived them of the ability to develop their normal abilities as an autonomous human being. So that really ramps up in the 90s. And so we begin to get a more fragile generation. We begin to get kids who are not as robust. And then social media, I think, is the reason why the cutoff is so sharp. Yeah. Because Facebook opens up, it used to just be for college students when it came out. And then in 2006, now it opens up to anybody who lies and says they're 13. But, you know, but 11-year-olds aren't really getting on Facebook in 2006. And then the iPhone comes out in 2007. But it's expensive, and so 11-year-olds don't really have iPhones in 2007. But by 2011, they mostly do. Most teenagers now have an iPhone and social media, and they're checking it hundreds of times a day. There's a wonderful book called iGen by Jean Twenge. This is what really clued us into the sharpness of it.
Yep.
You look at the behavior changes that happened. The late millennials are still getting driver's licenses. They still sometimes drink with their friends. And they still sometimes go out on dates and go to work at jobs. But beginning with kids born in 1995, all that plummets. Because all they're doing is sitting home alone on their devices. And if you do that, it seems, if you get social media in college, it doesn't seem to be bad for your brain. But if you get it at age 11, 12, or 13, now your brain is just beginning to develop, and your parents let you have your device at night, so you're sitting there, and somebody just commented on something you said, and you know, you're trying to go to sleep, but you're worried about it. And so if you imagine 11 to 13-year-olds bathed in stress hormones and not sleeping year after year, yeah, suddenly, when they show up in college in September of 2013, yep. It's like from out of nowhere.
Yeah, it did line up extraordinarily well when we were looking into it. And I think of social media, John and I think of social media as something that really sped up two different factors. Certainly, you know, the depression and anxiety, if you look at the data, you know, when people use a lot of it, they tend to be more depressed. It doesn't explain enough of the variance, but...
Okay, that's just one part of a longer... one-hour interview done at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. But they opened up several different ideas to us. The age at which a young person becomes exposed to the Internet, and then what's being shared on the Internet. Your friends are not the people you meet with every day and can engage as historically people did throughout the world. That's part of building a social network and understanding how life is, not just for yourself, but then you start comparing your parenting, what you have, what toys you have, what things you're allowed to do or not allowed to do. And this is what children normally do. This is a normal, healthy way. Experimenting with things and failing, learning the consequences where the boundaries of appropriate behavior, manners, morals, ethics, character development. And remember, today, there are certainly parents who appreciate that there must be a division. They're not there to be the best friend of their children. They're there to be a wise oracle parent, giving them guidance, enough freedom to experience life, and hopefully, when failing at something, learn that don't take it personally. Learn what you failed at so you'll be less likely the next time. Instead of failing, and then, as the guy said, quitting. Any criticism at all, any criticism, is now perceived as a threat to their very emotional existence. So there's no strength of character. There's no morals. There's no, I mean, today you would not believe the amount of pornography that the young people create themselves and share amongst themselves. as some kind of merit badge. But they have been desensitized to the consequences of cause and effect. They don't realize that for every action, there's an equal reaction. It just doesn't always come in that moment. Eat enough hamburgers, drink enough coffee, smoke enough cigarettes, eat enough French fries, and you're going to be obese, have heart disease and lung cancer sooner rather than later. But we don't know when that will be. So we assume that since it's not immediate, instantaneous, and yet all of our desires are instantaneous, I want to be liked today, I want shares today, and I can reach out to millions of people or whatever the universe they're sailing on in the internet provides them. But it's all artificial. It's not real. It's all from people who are not wise, have not experienced life, and still are in the development stage where historically you were given chores, you were given responsibilities, you had hobbies. Part of that responsibility was being able to work within your community. So you were an extension of your community. You were proud of your community, and communities worked together. And as a result, we had some stability. Then you were measured by whether you were an honest person or cared about other people, were empathetic and contributed to a better cause, that developed character. That's, for all intents and purposes, missing in a lot of our society today. So little wonder that when people go to school and then are told that the parents are the problem, that don't use the word mother and father, brother and sister, because it's insulting someone at some place for some reason, that you're absolutely certain that you're the only one who should be privileged with freedom of speech, and therefore on this campus, if we have someone who's going to say something that we don't like, shout them down, and hence the big shout downs. And so you don't realize, why should you be afraid of what someone is saying in a lecture that you weren't invited to? Why not go in and sit down and then in the discussion period where you can get up and raise your questions, offer your challenge? That's legitimate, open to debate in a civil manner. Cursing people, blaring horns in the middle of their lecture, that's just disruptive, tearing down the ability of someone to share an idea who is an actual expert in an area is the norm today, and it doesn't make any sense. So we have nonsensical, childish, grossly immature behavior on the part of people who should be in a higher educational institution, and yet they're doing just the opposite. The trouble is the professors have acquiesced, because this same Dr. Hyde, in a separate lecture that I have that you'll be hearing on a different day, said that he used to use a lot of humor and videos. He doesn't do either now. He's afraid. He literally abdicated the responsibility for how class is taught to the students, as if he's in a field of emotional minds, and if he steps on one of these minds by saying something that someone suddenly feels their whole life is in threat because they're not in a safe space, because college is supposed to be a place where it's safe. No, college has never been a place that's supposed to be safe from ideas and from discussion. It should be a place where you go in to debate, to hear things that make you feel uncomfortable, to create a little intellectual, emotional, and character resilience. No, this is the most coddled, babied, pampered, spoiled generation in American history, and now we're seeing the consequences. Right now, There is the criminalization of dissent, including today they were attacking Matt Taibbi because he simply was showing how the Democrats currently are refusing to go along with Biden's new stimulus unless it also provides a big loophole for rich Democrats not to pay a lot of taxes. For that, he was demeaned. Jerry Adler said that he should not be allowed to print that article. It should be completely erased. Since when does a member of Congress, who most of them are sociopaths and pathological liars, since when do they have the right to say whose speech is allowed and who's not? So anyone who differs with anything on COVID, criminalize it. Anyone who differs on our environmental way we're approaching the environment, criminalize it. Anyone who is against our foreign wars and interventions, illegal interventions that cause genocide and destruction of other lives, like in Yemen, supporting Saudi Arabia, and the starvation right today. There'll be kids dying today because of these politicians who want to stop Chris Hedges, stop Naomi Wolf, and anyone else who speaks the truth to their power. This is what C.J. Hopkins has to say. Quote, "One of the hallmarks of totalitarian systems is the criminalization of dissent. not just the stigmatization of dissent or the demonization of dissent, but the formal criminalization of dissent and any other type of opposition to the official ideology of the totalitarian system. Global capitalism has been inching its way towards this step for quite some time, and now, apparently, it is ready to take it. Germany has been leading the way. For over a year, anyone questioning or protesting the COVID emergency measures or the official COVID-19 narrative has been demonized by the government and the media, and sadly, but not completely unexpectedly, the majority of the German public. Wow, 1933 all over again. And now such dissent is officially extremism. Ah, change the word dissent to extremism, and now you can create laws against it. Yes, that's right. The new normal, Germany, if you dissent from the official state ideology, you're now officially a dangerous extremist. The German intelligence agency, the BFE, has been inventing a new category of extremists in order to allow themselves to legally monitor anyone suspected of being anti-democratic or delegitimizing the state in a way that endangers security. That's what they say. What doesn't endanger any security or the state is simply telling the truth. Naturally, I'm a little worried, as I have, quote, I've engaged in most of these extremist activities. My thought crimes are just sitting there on the internet, waiting to be scrutinized by the German secret police. They're probably Google translating this column right now, compiling a list of all the people reading it and their Facebook friends and Twitter followers and professional associations and family members and anyone of the aforementioned people have potentially met with or casually mentioned who might have engaged in similar thought crimes. You probably think I'm joking, don't you? I'm not joking, not even slightly. The Federal Office for Protection of the Constitution is monitoring anyone questioning or challenging the official new normal ideology, the COVID deniers, the conspiracy theorists, the anti-vaxxers, the dreaded people who think outside the box, and anyone else they feel like monitoring who has refused to join the COVIDian cult. We're now official enemies of the state, no different than any other terrorist, or okay, technically a little different. And so there it goes in Germany, and so too in the United States. And that's what we're dealing with today. And by the way, just to put it on the record, this is a highly cited COVID doctor, comes with a stunning conclusion, quote, the government is scrubbing unprecedented numbers of injection-related deaths. LeoHolman.com, quote, one of the world's prominent medical doctors with expertise in treating COVID has gone on the record with a scathing rebuke of the United States government's approach to fighting virus. He says the government's strategy, carried out in cooperation with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the United Nations World Health Organization, has resulted in tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths and is now being followed up with thousands more deaths caused by mass vaccination program. And this is Dr. Peter McCullough in a 32-minute interview with journalist Alex Newman. And so, wow, we've been saying this all along. Now, how many people do we know officially have died in the United States? 3,544. But mind you, only 1% of deaths are actually reported. So that's over 35,000 people have died, minimally, and over 100,000 have been injured. And yet, we weren't told this, and we won't be told it. So they're playing the numbers. So needless to say, that person is now on an enemies list. So when we criminalize dissent of any kind, and that's what we're doing, and who are the ones most likely to demand censorship and book burnings, which we've had in the United States in the last several months? The young people that they were just talking about. But there's a missing point to this, and what is it? And that is that I've also found from my own counseling, which is extensive, and research, that it's now coming mainly from the professional class, meaning people who have higher educations, who've worked hard, who are lawyers, doctors, scientists, professors, engineers, architects, people living a higher standard of existence, And here's the trade-off. Do you remember when you and I came home from school? There was generally someone to meet us, more often than not, our mother. Do you remember when we'd go to dinner, you know, sit down all at the table, 5 or 6 o'clock, and whatever we had to say, do, share, we did. Do you remember when we were accountable for our actions? I do. I know many of you do. Now that's always being all being discouraged. In fact, it's being attacked. The new normal is that the nuclear family, the mother, the father, the grandparents, that's anti-human in their opinion. It should be completely rebuked. And yet they'll go onto a college campus and demand the dismissal of someone that they've never met, whose work they've never read, and whose lectures they've never attended, because that's the danger of the mob. It can't think outside of the collective. Wow, I thought Germany learned a lesson in 1933. Evidently not. So who knows what they're capable of doing this time? No, they won't do the concentration camps. But when you start terrorizing people who are your leading thinkers, people who are not willing to be rubber stamping, then ideologically you're right back at the same place, just without the capacity to do the same damage to people. But in the United States, we have a whole movement that is massively racist. To be guilty of a genetic sin, you were born Caucasian. So all Caucasians, from the Pope to all the Jews, who, oh, you're Caucasian, therefore you are, well, which Jews? There's some Jews that come from other countries that would not agree that they're Caucasian, but a lot are. Are you saying that they're racist? The absurdity, the lack of intellectual acumen, the lack of scholarship, the lack of any truth in this is mind-numbing. So now the anti-racists are the pro-racists, the anti-fascists, the pro-fascists, and we're all seeing it. At what point would the silent majority of about 200 to 250 million Americans push back? That day is ahead, and I regret that that's going to happen, but it's inevitable. When you have power and you have no knowledge, no spiritual values, you'll push that power until you push someone down, and when you go to step on their face or neck, they're going to get up and they're going to push you back. Except these people are going to push hard back. Just, I'm telling you this, the media is out of control and it's cheerleading this. It's like it's applauding and saying, thumbs down, destroy these people. That is the level of integrity the New York Times, CNN, and all the other media in the United States, including a lot of the so-called liberal media that supported the white helmets, that supported the invasion of Syria. My God, that gets money from George Soros. Don't tell me how progressive you are. You're regressive. So these professionals, they're not there when their kids come home, not just for dinner, not when they're at home after school, not monitoring anything they're watching, not having any discussions about the consequences of what you should believe and how college is meant for critical thinking adjustments rather than what to believe and being indoctrinated. Instead, you are given tutors and nannies, people to protect you or help you because you're special and you're precious and you're perfect. Just the way you are. You get a trophy even if you didn't compete. You want to get the same opportunity but have the same results. You don't have to do good in school. Get someone else to do your grades for you. But we'll get you into the best schools and we'll get you into a private school and we'll get you everything. You don't have to go to scout camp. You know, we'll have a gourmet chef come and cook your meals in a tent that looks like a Manhattan beautiful apartment. We don't want you to suffer. Never get your hands in the soil. Live in this bubble. And as a result, we have about 17 million professionals. That means we have almost 70 million people between the richest and the professional class who are infected with this entitlement that work as hard as you can, but don't give that quality time to the children as they're evolving because somehow they'll do fine. Because after all, they're my genes, they're from my family. They're look at all that they've been given, every opportunity. But they didn't want all that. They just wanted you, and that's what they needed, and you weren't there. That's what's missing in all these equations. The sense of kids growing up, feeling that they don't have to associate with the real world, it's real problems, and I see nothing being done to solve those real problems. False intellect, false aspirations, even on the environment. I want to say goodbye to our WBI audience. You have to do the news for everyone else. We're continuing up to the top of the hour by going to prn.fm. Now, I want to read you this from Philip Marcello from Associated Press. Anti-vax rabbi dismissed by Jewish organization. A prominent Jewish organization is cutting ties with a Massachusetts rabbi for a vocal opposition to the coronavirus vaccine and other public health efforts to rein in the pandemic. All right. What exactly did that rabbi say that made everybody lose their mind? Well, nothing. He just wrote a letter to his doctor. And when I read the letter, I found it to be completely accurate in what he was saying. Here is the letter. You determine for yourself. Dear doctor, this is April 29, 2021. Thank you for a recent correspondence in which you eagerly invited me to receive the COVID-19 vaccine at your clinic. You wrote, quote, COVID-19 vaccination is safe, effective, and is our path to controlling the pandemic, end quote. Kindly provide documentation that I may share with my lawyer, certifying that you take full fiscal responsibility for any injury resulting from your safe vaccine. If you cannot take actual responsibility for its safety, I'll disregard your invitation and will caution my entire community to do the same. Moreover, I will advise them that you are parroting specious rhetoric that this injection is safe and effective, but are unwilling to back up your claims. We'll all realize that by refusing to accept liability for your product, which you are actively promoting, you're effectively conceding that it is neither safe nor effective. Lastly, your enthusiasm to expose me to a product that you cannot even vouch for will indicate that you do not truly care about my health as your individual patient, but rather that your loyalties lie with state policies and your own profit margin that's apparently dependent upon the number of COVID vaccine doses you administer. Your lack of response to this letter will expose you as a politically motivated businessman who marches in lockstep with government and who cares little about the individual health of his patients, rather than the kind and caring family doctor you always purported to be. Thank you in advance for making this so painfully evident. While I wish you success in your endeavors and your personal life, I can no longer subject myself or my family to the risk of having you as their doctor. In fact, I wouldn't even want you as an auto mechanic. Have you considered a new career as a used car salesman? Anyway, thank you again for your kind correspondence. Have a wonderful day, and please stay safe out there from all the upcoming malpractice lawsuits and impending Nuremberg trial indictments. Sincerely, and then Rabbi Michael Green to his former doctor. And for that, he was thrown out of the local community efforts. He still maintains his shul, still maintains his congregation, that they can't take away from him. Now, mind you, nothing that he said was unethical. Nothing was inaccurate. And yet the doctor was both unethical and inaccurate. How so? Because the doctor should realize when historically any product, including the vaccine back in, when was it, 1976, somewhere around there, when the swine flu, it was pulled from the market after just a limited number of deaths. And then it wasn't allowed again. But here, but 40 million Americans were vaccinated. So here we have over 3,500 known and provable by the government's own vaccine adverse event reporting system, but that's only like 1% maximum, or 2% of actual deaths. So when you have the government saying, yeah, we had 3,500 people who died, what if you told the people at least a minimum of 3,500 of you are going to die and you're in that lottery, but it's more likely 35,000, and that's just with the vaccine. And then a couple hundred thousand of you are going to be injured, and that's minimum. Well, how many people are going to say, yeah, I want in on that. I'm willing to play Christopher Walken's character in The Deer Hunter in the last scenes where he's doped out in a Saigon bar playing Russian roulette. No, there's no study yet that can prove any of the current vaccines are actually safe and effective. That will take at least 3 years for the evidence to come in. Everything else is public relations. So putting a patient at risk over something that's never been done, then you're saying that the American public are the guinea pigs. And you're getting profit from that because the doctors are paid for every one of those vaccines. So he was correct, and for that, they lanced him. So join those who are now suffering because you told the truth. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.